Welcome to the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast. On this podcast, let's step aside from our busy lives to have fun, fascinating, life-giving conversation with inspiring authors, pastors, sports personalities, and other influencers, leaders, and followers. Sit back, grab some coffee, or head down the road, and let's get the good and gold from today's guest. Here's Jeff Pinkleton, Executive Director of the Gathering of the Miami Valley, where their mission is to connect men to men and men to God.
Hello, friends. Welcome again today to another episode of the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast, where we like to talk all things life, leadership, lessons therein. And we tend to do that in a world of sports, of comedy, of music, business, pastoral, books, great testimonies, and the like. And today we're going to do that in many spaces. When I was looking up our guest today, Chuck DeGroat, I'm kind of blown away when I look at Amazon. I feel like a lot of people, when they write a book, every book that follows up is very similar to the book before with a slight twist. And Chuck, you've written some books that none of them go anywhere close together. They're all in their own separate space. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I alluded to earlier that we've taken a while to get to this point. I think I first reached out to you, found your email two and a half years ago or whatever. And you kind of chuckled before we got on here about you being, you didn't say it like this, but kind of a no guy, and you're not afraid to say no. How much does that dictate in a positive way your life, that you don't mind saying no?
Well, it's been a struggle, to be honest. I mean, first of all, I thought we were talking about sports today. Isn't this all sports?
Well, you're in Michigan. I've been saying, who in America hasn't been cheering for the Detroit Lions unless you're Packers, Vikings, or Bears fans? So we could talk. I mean, a sports writer for 4 years. We'll talk sports all day.
Great story. I'm more of a, I grew up on Long Island. I'm more of a heartbroken Knicks fan. And, so let's talk about no for a second. You know, I've learned it by saying yes too much. And I think you were just talking about these books. You know, the book Wholeheartedness was a really important one that came out of looking at my own divisions and contradictions and recognizing that my yes is often not a wholehearted yes. You know, when I'm asked to do something or the work that I do to see a client, whatever it might be, lead a retreat, I've said yes because I felt like I've needed to say yes, or because I've needed the money and I've lived out of fear or whatever it is, rather than trust, rather than a deep sense of wholeheartedness. And so, I'm getting better at it, but I still stink at it.
Well, from what I'm gathering, it seems like you're pretty good at it. I mean, I got to show you, we're going to go off here on a tangent. I'm going to show you this picture since you're a big Knicks fan. The one you don't recognize is my son, Alex, who plays basketball point guard for his team. Yeah. You should know that other guy.
That's Jalen, right?
Jalen Brunson. And on the other side of that, he had his career high that night, Dante DiVincenzo.
Oh, there he is. Yeah. Dante, who came over from the Warriors. I lived in San Francisco for 5 years, so I can also be a Warriors fan for that reason.
It sounds like you're a pretty big sports fan. Are you, people either love Steph or they hate Steph? I love Steph. What's your take on Steph?
I love it. Yeah. Sports has been life for me for many, many years. And I can get a little too caught up in it.
But you love Steph Curry? Is that what, did I hear you right on that?
Oh, Steph. Steph. I love Steph. Steph. I mean, I think he revolutionized the game, right? As a 3-point shooter. I mean, he's not a Jordan or a LeBron, but I love who he is. I love what he represents. I love his attitude. I love his family life. I love the playfulness.
Yep. We're on the same page. I got a friend of mine who, he is a big Steph hater. God loves Jesus. And I'm like, come on, man, we don't know everybody's life deep on the inside and where they're really at. But I mean, everything I've heard about Steph, the guy knows and loves Jesus. Like, let's cheer that on to some degree. He's revolutionized the game. We had lunch with a friend of mine who's a vice president with the Indiana Pacers. And I said, okay, settle something for me. I'm not going to lead you in any way. Steph Curry, go. And he raved about Steph Curry. I'm like, well, there you go. I guess I win that argument. And we're asking a VP in the NBA. I guess he knows what he's talking about. So
really good, really solid.
Chuck, let's talk about you coming to Jesus. Tell us the story of how you came to Christ.
Well, it's uneventful in some ways. I grew up in a home in which my mom and dad came to Christ because they wanted to get their kid baptized. They took me to church, to Peace Lutheran Church in Bohemia, New York, And they found Jesus at Peace Lutheran Church, this tiny little church. And so I was raised in the faith. And in a sense, I mean, I'm one of those guys who has never known a day where I have not felt the embrace of God. I mean, I really deep sense of union, connection to God, even as a young kid. And of course, you know, you go through your middle school and your high school years, and you have these moments where the youth pastor is saying, now at this moment, you know, will you walk forward and give your life to Christ? And in a sense, I always had this sense of like, I did in baptism. That's where it began. And so I'm one of those guys who has felt the grace of feeling the embrace for my whole life. And I'm grateful for that.
Amen. I like that phrase. I don't know. My guess is you use it quite a bit, but the embrace of God, something about you saying that just kind of resonates with my heart. Do you spend a lot of time? I feel like this is becoming more popular in Christian culture in a really good way. Does the word beauty, what does that do for you?
Yeah. I mean, that's a sort of a heartbeat for me. And I think that going all the way back to my seminary days, when I was sort of confronted with some of my own sin and arrogance and began to do my own work, felt like my senses opened up to God, to the world, to beauty, to goodness, to seeing. I love how Thomas Merton talks about, you know, you look out and you see the trees, and what trees do is nothing other than tree. That's what they were designed for, to lift their limbs to God, right? He says, we're the only creatures that God has made who refuse to be what we've been made for, right? Wow. Refuse to live out of our deepest and truest selves. And so I love to walk through the pine grove near our seminary and look up at the trees and say, thanks for teaching me how to be me. Thanks for treeing and teaching me how to be Chuck and to simply live out of the life that God has given me. And so, yeah, beauty speaks my heart.
It's funny, having been in Holland and been on your campus, I wish people knew, if they haven't been there, what there's most people are probably here in Holland, Michigan, and thinking beauty. It's a very beautiful place. A lot of neat stuff on that property. The church, yeah, where that conference was, I told you about with the doxology conference. I loved even the setting in and around the church where they have chairs just laid out everywhere. They're clearly trying to make it very relational. So tell people more about what your life looks like. You're very engaged in a number of different areas. You seem to have a lot of interests. You seem to really enjoy life. So what is Chuck DeGroat's assignment right now?
Yeah, right now. Well, for the last 10 years, I've been at Western Theological Seminary. I was a pastor in Orlando and San Francisco before that. But my life over the last 10 years, I'm 53, has been taking some of what I learned. I was very active in a church planting movement going back to the late 1990s, early 2000s. Started a church within a larger church. And so I've got some planting experience and have done a lot of planting assessment. Started a school for church planting out in the Bay Area. I mean, been very involved in that, but had this sense in about 10 years ago that I wanted to turn it around and offer something to pastors, you know, by way of training and formation. And so it's not only that, it's starting a clinical mental health counseling program, which will begin in the fall.
Wow.
And doing this writing that I've gotten to do over the years. And so I'm a hybrid pastor, therapist, author, and I love to live at the intersection of all of those things.
Well, let's talk about your books. So your biggest one, I think, is When Narcissism Comes to Church, Wholeheartedness, you've already alluded to, Toughest People to Love, and Leaving Egypt. Give us all of those titles and what they're about seem to connect with me, like I want to read all four of them. Tell us about, in a one, two-sentence pitch about those books.
Yeah. It almost makes me sad that the most popular is the narcissism book, right? Because my heart goes back to the first one, Leaving Egypt, Finding God in the Wilderness Spaces, which is to say that as we take our journeys from Egypt to the Promised Land, we all have to navigate a wilderness. And how do we find God in the wilderness? Toughest People to Love was a book about my learnings on leadership, right? And how to love people who are not very lovable, not very easy to love, who are very challenging. You know, as a pastor, those Monday morning emails that you get from the folks who hated your sermon and don't like your church and the color of the carpet and the taste of the wine at communion, whatever it is, right? Wholeheartedness a book that reflected some of my learnings after pretty well burning out in 2011, 2012. I ended up in a hospital in Mexico in surgery, had my gallbladder out. They discovered my system was septic, and it was the result of years of pushing and pushing and pushing and living a fairly divided life, even though I was inviting people into deep union and communion with God. I was leading people on retreats in the Bay Area. And so that was a book that came out of those learnings. And then When Narcissism Comes to Church was sort of a challenge by a pastoral staff of a mega church that I'd worked with and did some consulting with. And they said, we've learned a lot from you. Why haven't you written on this? And I said, this is the last thing I want to write about. Mm-hmm. And it was a challenge. We think you ought to do that. And IVP expressed interest. And it was a book that I sort of wrote fairly quickly based on what I knew. I've been doing the work for a number of years. And it just so happened to catch fire at a time when some others were writing in this area. And we were witnessing some challenging things in the church during that time. And so it's hit at a particular cultural moment, you might say.
So let's stay with that book for a moment. That's not where I was going next, but let's stay with that book. So that book came out and you would have been writing it, I think a little over 4 years ago. So it came out, I think like April, was it 2020? Is that right?
When 22, right? Yeah. Was it 22? I should know.
Hey, you know what? It's in front of me.
COVID, was that 21 or 22 when COVID sort of hit? Was that 20?
2020. Yeah. March 17th, 2020, it came out. So
okay. 2020.
Four years ago plus, you wrote that book. How would it be different now? Like what would, if you wrote that book right now, what would be ramped up in it? What would you say? Okay, maybe we're better in this area. That's not in there this time. I'm guessing it would be more ramped up though.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would have written it with more nuance. I mean, I did not think that we would be talking about these things in quite the way we've talked about them over the last 4 years. Think about some of the podcasts that have come out about big name pastors that have risen and fallen, right? It's and so in a sense, the book that I finished writing, it will come out in October, is the nuance. But yeah, I would have I really wanted to emphasize the way of Jesus in the book. And I think I did. I wanted Philippians 2 to be central to it. The way of Jesus, the humility of Jesus. And I wanted to diagnose how power is used and misused in people and in systems. It's easy to look back now, 4 years now. I can't believe it's been 4 years, but 4 years later and look at some of the rhetoric around this and say, boy, this rhetoric can become really toxic. And to sort of convey a way of wisdom in the way we talk about these things, which I try to do, because I don't think you combat a lack of humility with a lack of humility, arrogance with arrogance. And so I think the way of the cross always has to be modeled in one's character, in one's way of being in the world. I know, you know, it's interesting. Some people, I had someone invite me onto a podcast and say, I wasn't sure about inviting you on because I thought you were just attacking pastors. And then I read your book and I thought, oh, no. First of all, you were a pastor and very much still are a pastor. And you're very much for pastors and simply want to see the church grow and mature to become who she was meant to be, right? And I said, yeah, that's my heartbeat.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to take a risk here because I know there's probably people who might hear this. You're going to probably be a little ticked off at me because I'm going to make a statement and a question that's pretty black and white. Do you think we in today's day and age and culture with where we are with the church world, are too many people taking on church hurt and church pain on a very secondary, not even dealing directly with them? And it's just kind of out there. So I'm looking for problems. So I'm going to grab it. Or if someone says church hurt, church pain, I've been bullied, I've been power struggle, whatever, and it's not even close to them, but they're trying to own it. Do we make that okay? I mean, what I feel like sometimes we're allowing people to take on church hurt and church pain. It maybe isn't even real to them.
Yeah, well, so I don't know that I want to make a generalization like that because I sit with people every day and I hear their stories and people's stories are their stories and I want to take them seriously. You know, people experience hurt. I think in many ways, when it comes to this, it's been way underdiagnosed. We haven't talked about it. There are stories that I'm carrying right now that would shock people to hear, the kinds of people, kinds of pastors, people who we think were people of character and substance, who have abused people, assaulted, sexually assaulted. I mean, it's there's massive pain out there. And what I often say is we're in a moment of profound reckoning, and we ought not be afraid of that. In this sense, if Jesus is Lord of the church, there's room for death and resurrection. And we've seen this happen before. 500 years ago, there was a significant reformation within the church. And I think in many ways, the heartbeat of this is similar. How has the church abused power? And how can we call the church back to the way of Jesus, the way of humility? And that's not going to be easy. And there will be people that sort of latch on to get at what you're saying. And so let's sort of work with them as we need to work with them separately. But I think the heart of it needs to be remembered that there is a significant problem with power. People have been hurt. The chatter about it can sometimes be really painfully overwrought. That's the nicest way I can say it. You know, I do think for people like me who do the work on the ground, we haven't talked about this quite enough in the right kinds of ways. And so I'll just hit a period there and you can follow up if you want to.
Well, there's several places I want to go with that. I'm thinking of a story that's been out for a while now where there was some of what we're talking about on a large size level. And I've seen someone I know who I really respect in many ways who has talked about this particular church hurt and church pain a lot. I mean, they've talked about it a lot. What are the contexts in which we should talk about it? Because my big fear sometimes when we talk about this topic is, especially if we're doing it a lot on social media, we're talking about something where people are looking like, oh yeah, I'm ready to bust pastors. I'm ready to bust churches. I'm ready to slam. And it just feels like you're just giving gasoline to people who don't know the Lord and want to come after the church. So how do we do it in a productive way? And obviously you're wanting to communicate it maybe a little bit larger than just on a personal relationship level. I feel like I see Christians, I feel like sometimes maybe do too much damage just by trying to communicate it themselves.
Yeah, I would say this. I mean, I think that if you find that you work for a corporation and you find out that your CEO is cooking the books or abusing power, you're going to be disappointed. But when you see it happen in the church, you're going to feel betrayed because this is the church. These are followers of Jesus. And I think that the secondary trauma, in a sense, that people are experiencing is this sense of, oh my goodness, it's there, it's there, it's him. I remember hearing the news about Jean Vanier, which went straight to my core. You know, Jean Vanier, who played such a big part in Henry Nouwen's journey, the formation of the ministry of L'Arche, a community of disability, and hearing that he was a serial sexual assaulter, essentially, right? And having this sense of, my goodness, when is this going to end, right? And so I think that secondary trauma, in a sense, that what people are experiencing is that this is the Church of Jesus Christ. And they're hearing these stories now of men in particular, you know, who have authority and have platforms and have written books, even on grace and on goodness. And I do think it impacts them, even if it doesn't impact them directly. And so, you know, but I'm a therapist, and I'm, you know, my work is to listen really carefully to the uniqueness of people's stories and pain. And so, you know, that's what I pick up on in the stories that I'm hearing.
Does it ever get overwhelming to you that you've kind of been thrust into this world, maybe more than you wanted it, by writing a book that popped? And you're like, whoa, everybody, hey, I don't want to spend this much time here. Like, I don't need to deal with, like, I can imagine, I'm thinking of a regional situation, a national situation, someone I know. And I'm thinking you could be getting phone calls all the time from people saying, hey, we got this happening, or I just struggled with this. I need your help, Chuck. I could see some barrier, some no's you have to put up to say, I got to look out for my own soul.
So one of the messages that I get often from people is, you don't speak up enough. You have a platform on social media and you need to be doing more and saying more. And the reality is that I'm involved in lots of things behind the scenes, and I don't think it's particularly helpful to tweet 17 times a day about the latest and greatest scandal, right? The reality is I'm not involved in those. I do have some personal knowledge of some things going on, but there are things that pop up that I'm not doing research on. I haven't investigated. I'm not going to say, how dare you, you know? And so, but does it get overwhelming? I'll be honest with you. The first call I got from one of the first people who had read the narcissism book was from Central Florida Presbytery, the PCA, my first presbytery, big church planting presbytery. And he said to me, Chuck, I remember in about the year 2000 when we were, you know, one of the fastest growing church planting denominations in the United States and one of the fastest growing church planting presbyteries. And he said, you were saying this in 2000. And I can't tell you the number of church planters we sent out with hundreds of thousands of dollars who abused their power. And so there is a little part of me that feels like, you know, 20 years later, what I feel is heartbreak, to be honest with you. You know, like I've seen it, I've sensed it before it was going to happen. I've been involved in the psychological assessment of church planters, and heartbreak because we've gotten ahead of ourselves in the desire to spread the gospel. We've gotten ahead of ourselves. We sent these guys out who are immature with lots of money. I love this book called The Patient Ferment of the Early Church, because it seems that God is very happy to work in slow ways. Like yeast and bread, like a mustard seed, you know, but we've gotten ahead of ourselves and we're facing the consequences of that now, I think, in this massive reckoning.
Well, you have me looking up this book while we're talking, The Patient Ferment. There it is. I see it right there. So I knew you.
Oh, it's such a beautiful book.
I knew you'd bring some value and some resources for me I need to take a look at later. There are a couple people that know you who I know and wanted to pick their brain. Like, hey, if you were interviewed, Chuck, what are some questions you would ask? So I'm going to read this one pretty much word for word. So this one person said, trauma has become a more understood idea. In many cases, that is a good thing. But it seems like everyone is talking about having trauma. Is it possible much of what is described as trauma is simply life being hard? Is there a distinction between these two things?
Good question, because I think, on the one hand, I hear people say, you know, someone who drops their phone in a toilet bowl, you know, well, that was traumatizing, you know, whose favorite sports team loses the AFC championship. Well, that was traumatizing. And so, in a sense, we use that word without much care sometimes. On the other hand, for people like me who do the work, we are underdiagnosing trauma. And this is a much bigger conversation about how we're understanding the body now and how our body, quote unquote, keeps the score, right? But, you know, trauma is really the Greek word for wound. And what we're talking about is a wound of the soul. Let me just sort of frame it this way. The way I like to talk about it is abuse is what happens to you. Trauma is what happens within you. And so here's how I think we need to change the conversation. There are a lot of people talking about what happened to them. And this is my next book, is we need to pay attention to the impact of that within us, of the wound that we bear as a result of what happened to us. And the reality is that the nature of that wound is unique to each and every person. Two people can go through the same event. One person can have a lot of care. The church can come around them and show them love. Another person isolates, overdrinks, copes on their own. The person who copes on their own will bear the wound of trauma. And there are people who are doing life alone, outside of community, outside of Jesus, who bear wounds of trauma, and now outside the church because they've been wounded by the church. And so I want to attend to that wound within. But at the same time, we overuse the word at times and we need to be responsible.
Wow. So another question, and I'm going to do this word for word. Another person who knows of you or knows you, whichever it is, said millennials are much more willing to speak to counselors, therapists than boomers and Gen Xers. What are some of the benefits of this and what are some of the consequences? For instance, it seems like the word narcissism is being thrown around a lot lately. Is that an overused term in an over-therapized culture? Are we sticking a psychological term on a sin of pride and lack of love, or do terms like that help us confront the sin more effectively? I thought that was a great question. Couple questions, actually.
Well, I'm happy to call it arrogance, abuse of power, control, things like that. I mean, narcissism is a clinical word that gets, you know, and I get into that. I tease that out. So I think it's important sometimes to use these psychological categories in particular ways and places. But I think look at the Bible, look at the sort of the diagnosis of the abuse of power in scripture over and over and over again, and you'll see the problem. And then fast forward through church history, right? From Constantine on and the abuse of power within the church, you know, and so, yeah, we need to be talking about the abuse of power. We need to be talking about pride and arrogance and control, and why the way of Jesus, the way of humility, the one who did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but became nothing, who became a servant, why that's not enough for us, you know? And so that's a conversation that feels important to me. Yeah, I get the, it feels today, if you're just simply sort of listening to the white noise of social media, I can see why people are like, trauma, 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 narcissism, narcissism. Again, my desire is to listen to people's stories and to tease out the particularities. I mean, those of us who've been pastors, who do the work, pastors, counselors, we're interested. This is why a lot of us like Eugene Peterson, we're interested in the particularities of people's stories and how they've experienced pain, how they've sabotaged, sinned, how they've been wounded and hurt. And that's the core of the work.
Well, what's interesting is you mentioned Eugene Peterson, and I mentioned to you about this video I just saw called Godspeed.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting in there, him talking about listening and how much, maybe he didn't say it like this, but maybe we're overstating people wanting to be known and hiding, and how much people, and I'm a huge believer in this. When he started talking about this in that video, I'm like, thank you, because I've been saying this for a while. And if Eugene Peterson says it, well, it's probably just true, but how much we just love to hear our name. Like, just knowing people's names. He talked about back in the day when there were pastors who were trying to love on him or whatever, didn't even know his name. And where we make that kind of, so I appreciate your posture, Chuck, where you're bringing everything back to listening. I want to hit on, you talk about humility there. And I know humility is something with your book and other content, you've talked about humility quite a bit. So in light of not narcissism and other things we're talking about, you tell the story about the professor who challenged you early on and talked about how dangerous you were going to be. And that really got you going down this road of looking, you know, which probably was part of the wholeheartedness thing. Can we talk enough about humility? If humility would be a bridge and a tunnel towards life at its best, loving people well, is it possible to be too humble? I don't think it is.
No, I mean, there's a possibility of being self-deprecating. And,
yep.
And the problem there is that, you know, the shame that is characteristic of self-deprecation is the fuel for narcissistic, arrogant, controlling behavior, you know, because within the heart of every proud and arrogant person is someone who feels unlovable at some level, right? And so I do think, you know, when we talk about humility, yeah, I always go back to Genesis 3 and this. Well, I just go back to Genesis and this sense that, and I connected to Lent, and as a pastor, every Ash Wednesday, imposing ashes on people's foreheads and saying, "You are dust, and to dust you shall return." One of my favorite days of the year to impose ashes and to say, "You are dust, and to dust you shall return," which is to say, you're limited. You're not superhuman. You don't have to do it all. You don't have to save the church. I've talked to so many guys in church planning assessments who have said some version of, you know, "I need to go to that city because that city needs to hear the gospel." And I said, "How much time have you spent in that city? Have you talked to the pastors of the churches that have been there for a couple hundred years? You know, the small churches that might not be thriving, the black church in the neighborhood, you know, have you gone there to ask, how's the gospel embodied even now?" You know, and so we're limited. And I think that that's really important to remember. And maybe that's a part of the reckoning here is we're, as Eugene might say, we're all trying to make names for ourselves, you know? And so what might it look like to have a sort of revolution of humility? That'd be beautiful.
Yeah. When I think about people that are really humble, it's not about them, clearly. I mean, that goes by definition. And they do seem to just love really well. They listen well. They're present. I mean, anytime I love it's been probably seen many times, but the Eugene Peterson and his wife's video with Bono at Flathead Lake at their house. When I'm watching Godspeed, I'm just like, that guy seems really humble. When I talked to Will Graham on the podcast, he said, Billy Graham was the most humble person I know. Most humble person I know, period. He's not debating it. It's just true. And I think I saw someone post on Facebook the other day, kind of Joe McKeever, an 80-some-year-old pastor who's written some stuff over the years or whatever, and he said, too many pastors, he said, want to come at you with their title, the latest thing they've done, some book they've written. He talked about humility. He goes, because you're gonna learn humility one way or the other. And he goes, right now, let me tell you, it looks really good on you. And I love that line. Humility looks good on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are pastors right now in Idaho, in North Dakota, you know, in Tennessee, in South Florida, who are not on social media. They don't listen to your podcast. They've never heard of me or my book or books. You know, they're showing up, Church of 60, you know, preaching, serving humbly, not too worried about, you know, getting to the 250 mark or the 500 mark or the 1,000 barrier, not living anxiously. And, you know, their stories will never be told. I think that's the beautiful thing about Eugene Peterson. He was a pastor of an ordinary church in Maryland, right? It's not some famous cathedral church, some big city, right? And he wrote some humble books on following Jesus more closely, you know, and listening to scripture more deeply, and they caught on. And now then, of course, publishers get a hold of you and they try to blow you up and they get you in front of Bono and you're like, who's Bono? What's a Bono?
I love that.
I love stories like that. And I love my colleague Gwen Collier's telling of Eugene's story, because it's really just an phenomenal ordinary book. One. And ordinary is a really beautiful word. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to be ordinary. That I aspire to be ordinary. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. So with your pastor hat on, and you've been exposed, and you've been Florida, California, as you talk about that, you're getting to connect with people all over based on your book, and particularly narcissism book. From two testimonies I give about COVID for me. One, I really saw my relationship with the Lord take off in a new, different, fresh way, because I had time when it was hard. I really went to the Lord like I never had before in my life, and I grew significantly in the Lord over COVID. The other testimony for me in my life was I grew to really appreciate various types of churches. I've always leaned towards being a bigger church guy, because I just feel like resource-wise, opportunity, leadership, offerings, there's something about bigger churches. But I really grew to appreciate smaller, like you're saying, the 50-person church, the rural church, whatever. Do you think that happened? Did we grow as a culture and as a church to appreciate different churches, particularly smaller ones, more because of COVID?
I hope so. I'm not sure, because I think I think it's going to take a decade or more to fully understand the ramifications of all this, right? But I hope so. I do see people sort of gravitating toward the idea of house church and micro church and things like that, you know, and that's becoming sort of a brand now, you know, and I could see that becoming a problem in itself, you know, because then now we're doing the coolest and best microchurch. I don't know. We have a way, and it goes all the way back to Genesis 3. We have a way of taking beautiful things and crushing them, I guess, you know, sabotaging them. And so, and I'm well aware of that in my own life, because I've done that. And so, yeah, I hope so. That's why I mentioned that patient ferment of the early church, because I do think that God was doing a particular kind of thing in those first centuries of the church in ways that were fairly ordinary. They wouldn't make the headlines today. They certainly wouldn't want to do a podcast about them, because they didn't look very sexy. You know, they were just very ordinary.
Sure. I want to do the rapid five, which 80, 90% of the time we do these rapid five questions. And I thought Chuck's going to have some fun, lighthearted, good answers here, I think.
Okay.
So what is your favorite childhood snack or cereal?
So I loved Apple Jacks. I was an Apple Jacks guy.
That's a great answer. I like that answer a lot. Yeah. What is your favorite non-Chuck D book you most want to gift or have gifted to other people?
Probably Telling Secrets by Frederick Buechner.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's not an answer I've heard before. Why that book particularly?
Yeah. It's the third part of his pastoral trilogy, you know, where he reflects on a life, pastoral ministry and life of wisdom, right? It's a book about storytelling. It's a book about looking at his own life. And I just think it's very intimate. I read it every year for the first 10 years of pastoral ministry.
Oh, wow. Okay. So let's say you have an extended family vacation and you're going, let's say you're heading south, you're going to go past me in Ohio, and somewhere along the way, how many would you typically have? Let's say you're in a van. How many family members you got with you on this road trip?
Well, yeah. So now I have two adult daughters, 22 and 21. So usually the four of us.
Okay. So let's pretend this was a few years ago where they're younger, you know, bladders are getting out of control. And you're like, wow, we had to stop sooner than we wanted to. And on the exit sign, let's pretend all three of these appeared. You see McDonald's, Chick-fil-A, In-N-Out Burger. Team DeGroat is going where?
Man, we are not going to McDonald's because three of us are gluten-free. We're going to In-N-Out or we're going to Chick-fil-A, and that's going to be a fight. So
if you choose solely, where are you going?
Yeah, I'm probably going to In-N-Out.
Yeah. I do think that's the right answer. I think, you know, people want to, and I love Chick-fil-A. They want to throw the love on Chick-fil-A, but I'm like, you know, many places don't have In-N-Out Burger. So if you got the chance, come on.
I love my Christian chicken, but I love In-N-Out.
There you go. Chuck, what's a movie that every time you were to stumble across that, if you were old school changing channels and this movie popped up, you'd say, got to finish it?
Yeah. So Shawshank Redemption is the one that came to mind. It's just, so this dates some of us, you know, there are these movies that go way back that became like, this is the gospel. The Matrix is the gospel, you know. Shawshank Redemption, that was my movie. I got a lot of mileage out of that in Sermon Illustrations.
Now, you know, sort of between me to you, about an hour and 40 minutes away from me, is the prison where that was filmed. So you come down my neck of the woods, you can go to the prison where Shawshank Redemption. Oh,
that's so interesting. Yeah. Didn't know that.
All right, here's a big one. Always love this answer. First celebrity crush.
Okay, so yeah, I saw this, but I forgot to look up her name, but it was the original Battlestar Galactica. You know, back in the late 70s, and it was Athena on Battlestar Galactica. So you just have to kind of Google Athena. But if you're a pastor, probably not on your church account. And you're going to want to look up, you know, the early version of that. She was my first crush.
I'm not even sure who that is. I've looked her up, but who was Athena in the original Battlestar Galactica? Thank you, Google shares that. Maren Jensen.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
I've never seen her. I remember Battlestar Galactica. I guess I never watched it.
Yeah.
Wow. How old are you again, Chuck? Did you say 53?
53.
I'm 54. I always tell people at our age, there is a right answer to this question.
Yeah.
The correct answer is Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. But earlier we were talking about Daisy Duke, who is, I forget her name.
Yeah, Catherine Bach.
That had to be one for a lot of us back in the day. Yeah.
Heather Locklear. There's some other ones, no doubt. Yeah, so wholeheartedness. Talk a little bit more about that, because I do think you talked about when narcissism came out, there were some other people kind of talking about it, writing about it. I feel like with the topic of wholeheartedness and an unhurried life and ruthlessly eliminate hurry. And there's a lot of things about that topic with rest and margin and space and silence and stillness. And obviously a lot of that can even date back to Richard Foster and A Celebration of Discipline. Is that something that we only need more content because we still somehow don't get it? We still want to live this rat race life? Or do we see victory in this area for the church?
That's a tough question to ask, because I think the way I diagnose that, just to go back to Genesis 3 once again, is that we've been living these divided lives, you know, as early as Adam and Eve hiding under the fig leaves, right? And so we hide in our shame, we hide our anxiety, shame, and we live our lives like that. And at the same time, God comes running toward us, pursuing us, and that's sort of the gospel message of wholeheartedness. But we're pretty committed to living these divided lives because they work for us. And so I've said recently that in some ways, wholeheartedness is the antidote to narcissism. I mean, I should have reversed the order of the books. But it is an invitation to receive God's "Where are you?" in Genesis chapter 3, and to come out of hiding and to be known. I think that's in a sense the antidote, and that's my invitation to men when I lead men's retreats, and all the work that I do is, you know, come out of hiding and be known in your fragility, in your ordinariness. Amen. You don't have to live someone else's life. Be the tree. The tree exists to tree. So be Jeff, be Chuck, and live your life wholeheartedly.
Amen. So a friend of mine, he's a pretty brilliant guy, and he's known the higher ed college world. I asked him if he, by what he saw in you, would have a question. He said, from a counseling perspective, How can the church best prepare to minister effectively to those experiencing issues of gender identity and gender dysphoria?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Well, here again, I mean, I think the posture has to be the posture of Jesus, right? I mean, I think too often when these, in our particular cultural moment, when these kinds of things come up, there's this immediate surge of adrenaline and cortisol, and we're anxious and fearful. And my dad was a model for me in this. Grew up in a good evangelical Christian family, but my dad drove a guy to work regularly who's gay, worked with a woman who identified as a lesbian. And, you know, it wasn't the cultural hot button issue that it was. I knew these people by their first names, and I knew my dad loved them, and I knew that they were welcome at our house, and I knew my dad would come through for them in any way that he needed to come through for them. And so I think the way forward is the way of Jesus. It's a posture of moving toward. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, that's clearly a topic that's going to keep coming our way. And I like what you said there about how we just kind of, it becomes almost this explosion, and it's like our minds go so many different directions versus just calm, rest. Like you said, how would Jesus love? Because that, you're never going to go wrong. Like, I remember hearing once the question being asked, looking at a situation and asking the question, what does love require of me? And I've thought about that a lot. If we would ask that question going into about anything, what does love require of me here? Man, what a grounded question to ask and answer and then follow accordingly, I think, for much of our lives. So I'm going to ask you a question. My daughter has been wanting me to ask somebody this question. And I thought, you know what? Chuck seems hip enough on what's going on in culture and pop culture and sports and whatever. I think he's going to be a good guy for this question. What single would be your life's theme song, or what song sums up your story?
Did you tell me this? Ask me this one in advance?
It's on the list. Oh, man. Yeah, it's on the list.
What song would
sum up your life?
Sum up
your
life story. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. A song title isn't coming to mind, but it would have to be something that gets at unconditional love, an experience of God's embrace, as we talked about earlier, right? So is there a song title that comes to mind that gets at God's love, God's embrace?
I'll do some research and we'll find something out.
Yeah.
As you talked earlier in the last question, you know, a song that would come to my mind, because I've always said, I don't think they necessarily wrote this song to present the gospel, but I do think it's in there, is the Eagles' Desperado.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
That song ministers to me when I hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. I mean, I think that if there's an album, it would be the, why am I blanking on the name of it right now? But it would be Rich Mullins, the Ragamuffin Band.
Ragamuffin,
album,
yeah.
The Legacy, the, what is it called?
Yeah.
But with, yeah.
Have you read his biography James Smith wrote? Have you read his biography by James Smith?
No, I haven't.
When I was on sabbatical 2.5 years ago, I read, I don't know, 23 books or something like that. I read Burning My Bones as well by Owen, but one of those two books were the best one. And I might give it, if I had to lean one way, the Rich Mullins one might've been, because there was just some just very real honest, you know, Owen did a great job of that too, being very fair about not painting Eugene as a saint more than, you know, he needed to be. And so we'll come up with that. I'm going to think through what you said there and kind of come up with a response to that for you. Let me ask you this, and maybe we'll close with this one, Chuck. What is God bringing out in you right now? What is he developing in you as a character thing that he's saying, this is my work right now, 2024 for the year? And Chuck.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'll put it this way. After the narcissism book, as you might imagine, people wanted to talk a lot about that subject. And there, as you might expect, there's that sense of, you need to write your follow-up book to that. You know, you need to write the narcissism point too. And I really needed to spend time with God on that one. And because I had a very clear sense that I don't think that's it. That's been a big theme for me, is listening very carefully for the Spirit when there are other loud voices saying, and this gets back to where we started, you know, let your yes be yes and your no be no. What do you want from me, God, in this next season? Because I'm not just going to write another book or take a client or do a podcast just because they say, yeah, this is what everyone's talking about. And strike while the iron is hot. Is that the phrase? Right. And so it's been a sense of really listening to what people need. I'm thinking about the people I work with, my clients, and my writing, my next book has really emerged out of that deep sense of listening. And I don't think the subject is nearly as sexy in a sense. You know, I'm using the three questions of Genesis chapter 3, what I call the three questions of Genesis chapter 3, to invite people to encounter God in the midst of their wounds, their weariness and their wounds. But I think that that's the work. I mean, I think that there's this simple, and Eugene, to get back to Eugene, he really lived it. You know, when it came down to it, it wasn't about the next book he was going to write. It was about sitting with people and listening deeply, you know? And so that's the heart of it for me. Am I listening to the Spirit? And is my yes a wholehearted yes? Is my no a clear no? And I don't want to be caught up in the winds, the storm winds of you got to do this and it'd be best to do that. You probably know what I'm talking about when sure. It comes to that, because there are always those kinds of forces, you know?
You know, it's interesting about what you just said there. I was picturing Eugene talking to Matt, the guy in the video, who it's really about. And I definitely noticed his posture listening. It was just very relaxed, very focused. It didn't look like he was trying real hard. It was just kind of who he is. So your book again, October, you said it comes out. What is the title of it?
It's called Healing What's Within.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where can people find out more about what's going on with you, Chuck?
They can go to my website. It's chuckdegroat.net. I'm out here at Western Theological Seminary in Holland. It's a smaller seminary. It's very ordinary. Wynn Collier's here, who wrote the Eugene Peterson book. We're just doing ordinary things. It's not the big, sexy seminary, but you can find out more about me and us and the work that we're doing, trying to form pastors, women and men, for ministry at Western. So
needed.
Yeah, you can check that out too.
So needed. Well, hey, thanks for making this effort work. We've been back and forth quite a bit, and yeah. I'm better off for
thanks for your persistence.
Well, you know, it's funny. I tell people often when we have our twice a year outreach breakfast or podcasts or whatever else, the word persistent has been used to describe me a time or two. So somebody just messaged me today and they're like, how did you get Will Graham on your podcast? And I'm like, well, I asked him and I'm a bit persistent. And so
can I give you a quick compliment? I love how present, how embodied you are, even in this podcast. You know, I've done podcasts where people have their questions and they're doing is kind of reading off a script. And I love how you listen and how you'll pivot and we can go anywhere we sort of need to go. Like there's a basic script, right? But there's a sense of like, you're just listening for what, I guess, what strikes you as important and what needs to be asked. And so thanks for listening.
It really means a lot, Chuck. I mean, when we mentioned Detroit Lions earlier, got off on football, I could have stayed there throughout. I think it's, you know what it is. I tell people one of the gifts of this podcast is, you know, I've had people potentially come on here and they want to know about metrics and how many people listen. I'm like, I'll be honest with you. If you need that to decide whether you want to be on here or not, there's other podcasts, Kerry Newhoff, Andy Downs, Dadville, I love Dave and John. There's podcasts. This has helped me be more sensitive to Holy Spirit like nothing else in my life. And I can't say how grateful I am to that, because it's forced me to listen and say, all right, God, where is there more here that I need to hear or somebody else, or you're on something I don't want to miss.
Yeah, I feel it. I see it. So thanks.
Thank you.
I like that.
Well, hopefully between now and October, we won't be so long and we'll get back and talk specifically about the next book.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff.
All right, Chuck. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us on the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast. You can reach Jeff at gatheringmiamivalley.org or find us on Facebook at the Gathering of the Miami Valley. Join us again next week for another honest and rich conversation.
The Rise FM Podcast Network.